Hi, this is Kevin Amos. I want to welcome you to In Black America and Ebony Spectrum here on WRCT Pittsburgh. This week we're going to take a look at the words of Nikki Giovanni as she talks about white supremacy and some other things. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned.
White people, and I'm not picking on white, all of them, but quite a few of them, think they have a right to have more than everybody. And I think we have to teach them, and I don't know that we can, it's not my responsibility at this point, that there is something called enough. And I think white Americans have not learned what it means to have enough, so that they're never satisfied. They're always wanting more. And you cannot always have more, because that means someone else has less.
Hello and welcome to Ways to Change the World. I'm Krishnan Guru Murthy, and this is the podcast in which we talk to extraordinary people about the big ideas in their lives and the events that have helped shape them. My guest this week is a poet, an activist. She was a leading light in the Black Arts Movement, the civil rights movement of the 1960s and 70s in America. She became famous again as a long-standing professor at Virginia Tech, because when that school in America was struck by a mass shooting carried out by a former student there, she had been one of the teachers of that former student and had identified him, in her words, as evil. She wrote a poem about him which touched many people across the world, including the Queen of England. Nikki Giovanni, thank you very much for joining us.
I'm delighted to be here.
You've been angry at different points in your life, haven't you?
Yes, I have. I never used to think that I was angry the older I got, but I think there's still probably a smidgen of anger left.
Well, I mean, I want us to talk about right now. What makes you angry right now?
I really dislike Donald Trump. I don't like Nazis. I never did. And I dislike the way that people are trying to teach hate, because hate has to be taught. And people forget that you don't wake up in the morning and say, oh, I'm going to hate. Someone teaches you to hate.
I mean, as somebody who deals in the power of words, you used one of the most powerful words right then, right next to Donald Trump, Nazi. Just explain to me why you used that word.
I don't know what other word we could use. The United States, in which I was born, and for whatever countries mean, and it means less and less to me, but I'm an American. The capital of the United States hasn't been attacked since 1820, which was attacked actually by you people, by the British. And you lost because we became an independent nation. But we hadn't been attacked since 1820 until January the 6th. If that's not a Nazi, we can discuss, you know, then what he is.
I mean, let me go with your description for the sake of argument. I mean, obviously, Donald Trump's defenders will say that's a terrible thing to say, and he's an patriot and all the rest of it. We don't want to argue about that.
No, we don't.
Let us say that he's, for the sake of argument, a bad person. Why is he back in play when America, you know, last time around decided to kick him out?
We decided to elect Joe Biden. I think that was a good thing.
Do you think there is a racist backlash right now that is linked? Is it the same struggle, the one that you were fighting?
I don't think it's the same struggle. I think it's just another step in that struggle. That racism is a bad idea. And a lot of people are, well, one, we've sent a lot of our young men and women off to war to do horrible things. The United States has been at war since World War II. We had the Korean War, we had Vietnam, we had Afghanistan. We just got out of Afghanistan. And I think it's time that the United States realized that war is probably not one of the better ideas that we have. And then we bring these people home. We've made them shoot people, and then we bring them back. And the next thing you hear is that, well, he had health issues. Well, if you send him off and teach him to murder, what kind of issue do you think? Of course he's screaming in the middle of the night. He knows what he's done. And we need to quit that.
So do you think America's lost its sense of right and wrong?
I'm not wholly sure that it ever had a sense of right, but it certainly has embraced a sense of wrong, yes.
I mean, you know, all nations, all cultures have a sense of morality. I mean, what you seem to be saying is at least in the 1960s, you were able to articulate what was right and wrong. Was it obvious to you then that while you could end segregation, you couldn't end racism?
It was obvious because segregation is no colored allowed, whites only. And racism is it's an ingrained situation that we've taught these youngsters to respond to, that white people, and I'm not picking on white, all of them, but quite a few of them, think they have a right to have more than everybody. And I think we have to teach them, and I don't know that we can, it's not my responsibility at this point, that there is something called enough. And I think white Americans have not learned what it means to have enough, so that they're never satisfied. They're always wanting more. And you cannot always have more, because that means someone else has less.
I mean, is it about wanting more, or is it about people who feel they don't have enough? You know, that because a lot of that sort of drive in the 2016 election was about poor white America feeling the country, the system had failed it.
No, I think it was about them not reading enough books. I think we need a few more libraries. And I think we need to realize that this nation belongs to an earth. It belongs to a planet. And on this planet are living things, are life forms. And we have to have some respect for all of the life forms.
If there are other people who share your anger at contemporary politics, how does poetry help?
Poetry helps because poetry has invented and we've birthed, I guess is a better word, we have birthed the science that has led to the dreams that has created some of the solutions, not all of them, but some of them. Poetry is the one that says, okay, why can't I go into I want to go into outer space. Science didn't invent the poems to make it possible. Poetry invented the idea that made the science possible. Or science says, why does Franklin Roosevelt, who was not a bad guy, and he had the sense to marry Eleanor, who was a great woman, why does he have polio? Why is he spending his life in a wheelchair? Poetry says we can find some way of controlling that. And then the scientists say, and they're going to be doctor scientists in this way, well, let's find out what's causing this. Poetry has given birth to the best dreams of mankind. It's poetry that says all people were created equal. It wasn't science. It was poetry. So if we could get everybody reading, probably not me because I was a little angry at that point, but, you know, some of the nicer poems, then maybe we'll have better people. I don't know.
I mean, you've been fascinated in recent years with the Earth and the science of the Earth and the planets. What has sparked that? I mean, you've been up as well.
Yes.
To see the curvature of the Earth.
Yes. I would like for everybody to be able to do that because it would probably give people a little more respect for the planet upon which we live. But I think, again, we need to start with preschool, pre-kindergarten, teaching the life forms that we call human beings are, in fact, earthlings. So when people say, who are you? Your answer is, I'm an earthling. So that as you or your children or your grandchildren prepare for life in the galaxy, I'm not just talking about the space, but because we can all do the space station, that's not hard. But as we go on into the galaxy, as we meet other life forms, not to mention as we stay on this earth and meet other life forms, we are responding to the fact that we are all sharing this. We're all earthlings, whether we are in the water or in the air. We all have to have water, we all have to have air, and we all have to have some level of food, which means we are all some level of predator. But we can control. We don't have to be greedy. Having enough leaves something for everyone.
Now, in this book, this collection of your poems, there is a short bio of Nikki Giovanni.
Mm-hmm.
To take us back to the little girl. A long time ago, a little girl sat in the window of the bedroom she shared with her older sister and read by finger flashlight. Now, it goes on. She first fell in love with words. Then they somehow seemed to fall in love with her. tell me what happened.
I wish I knew, but it's been a lovely love affair. And we have carried it on, Words and I, all of these years. And I keep looking for what else are we learning? Because the only people we really don't like are the people with words. We kill, I happen to be a Christian, and we killed Jesus, we killed Socrates. We killed people, not because they did anything, but because they said something. So we know words are very powerful. We know that we killed Martin Luther King, we killed Malcolm, and I'm just talking about the United States. We did it because they used words, which are the most powerful thing that we have. I daydream, because that's all I have are words. I'm not talented. My sister was really pretty. She's gone now, but I had a really pretty sister. And I'm a baby sister. If you have an older sister who's really pretty, you know, you look and you say, okay, I'm not really pretty. And you start to eliminate what is it that I have. And all I had was observation, which is what I still have. And I still observe. I still watch. And some of the things that I watch, I find regrettable would not even be a strong enough word.
I mean, you have a poem again about yourself called Dickie Rosa, which I want to hear a little bit of.
Childhood remembrances are always a drag if you're Black. You always remember things like living in Woodlawn with no inside toilet. And if you become famous or something, they never talk about how happy you were to have your mother all to yourself. And how good the water felt when you got your bath from one of those big tubs that folk in Chicago barbecue in. And somehow, when you talk about home, it never gets across how much you understood their feelings as the whole family attended meetings about Hollydale. And even though you remember, your biographers never understand your father's pain as he sells his stock and another dream goes. And though you're poor, it isn't poverty that concerns you. And though they fought a lot, it isn't your father's drinking that makes any difference, but only that everybody is together, and you and your sister have happy birthdays and very good Christmases. And I really hope no white person ever has cause to write about me, because they never understand Black love is Black wealth, and they'll probably talk about my hard childhood and never understand that all the while I was quite happy.
Fantastic. I mean, have you been patronized by sort of white interviewers your whole life? Is that why you write that?
Oh, I don't know that I was so happy. I think happiness is a decision you make, because if you ask me what was I doing on Saturday night at about 11 o'clock, I was listening to my father hit my mother. And that is not a happiness. And fortunately, I had a grandmother, and grandpapa was a wonderful man. And I asked if I could live with them.
But how did you feel about having run away? Because, I mean, you'd said, you know, you'd either have to kill him or run away.
Or leave, yeah.
Did you do the right thing?
I did the right thing. Why is it that the man feels that he can mistreat someone who's trying to love him? But what's on his mind that this is the way you treat somebody? Because it's not the way you treat somebody. So no matter what else happened outside of that, home, you're supposed to smile when you come in. My favorite movie is The Godfather. And when Vito, when he loses his job, you remember? And he stops to get a pair for his wife. He's a good man, because that's all he has is this pair. And so that's what he's going to bring. He's not going to bring any crap about I was mistreated today. You don't know what they said to me. Oh, them, I'm being underpaid. None of that crap. But he has a pair, and he brings it to her. And that's what love is. I learned that from my grandfather, by the way. My grandmother loved pineapple. Well, now I always remember that. And pineapple isn't always in season. But when he came home, as he would come down the street, and just as he was turning up to our home, if they had pineapple, it was in season. Her name was Luvinia. And he would say, Luvinia? They had pineapple, and you could hear in his voice the joy that he could bring his wife pineapple. And all that I know about love, I learned from listening to him being that pleased to be able to give his wife a pineapple. And that's what love is. So that's what makes it important.
That's very moving.
Yes.
I want to come back to sort of the current day, sadly, and the things that people might want to write about now. I mean, we talked about Trump at the beginning, but I mean, in 2020, you did a poem for the Biden campaign about voting.
I just did it for voting. I didn't do it for Biden.
It was just for voting.
Well, you know, we have local elections. We have the mayor. People forget the little things matter too. I'm glad that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris won. But I wrote vote because you are a citizen, and because there is a great woman who will break my heart. I'll sit here and cry on your podcast, named Fannie Lou Hamer, who created the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. Mississippi, they must have had, you know, 2 cents. But she found a way to bring these people together. Not found a way, she's a great organizer. And she got enough money together from her group to rent a bus to go to the Atlantic City Convention of the Democrats. And Lyndon Johnson was president because Jack Kennedy had been assassinated. And she said to the Credentials Committee that they should be seated, not the traditional Mississippi Party, that they represented Mississippi. And of course, that's going to be the Democrats need the black vote. You know, there's no question about that. And so Lyndon Johnson was trying to find a way to make it all right, because that old Lyndon did things like that. And so he ultimately offered Mrs. Hamer 2 votes, 2 seats. And I will quote Ms. Hamer on that. She said, "We did not come here for no 2 seats." And she got back on her bus, she and her people got back on the bus and went back to Mississippi. Well, when the bus crossed the Mississippi line, the sheriff stopped the bus and they pulled her off. And it was one of the most horrible beatings ever. I mean, just they beat that woman. And I've always said, no matter what, if any part of me is alive, I'm going to vote. If my fingernails are growing, take a fingernail and say, "This is Nikki, she's going to vote." Because people have paid such a high price for black Americans to vote. And that's what that poem says. We are citizens. It's not a hug. It's not a kiss. It's not chocolate or vanilla. It's a vote. And you must vote. And that's what I wanted to say there.
And it's the same argument this year, isn't it?
Yeah.
For everybody.
For everybody. It really is.
Do you think it is a good thing for black people when you end up with a black president or a black vice president or a Asian prime minister? Do you think the racist unleashing that happens when those people from minorities get to power?
Well, one, we're not minorities. Let's start with the basic. We're not minorities. And two, I think that we are all earthlings. We're not minorities. Where I come from, black people are the majority, and that's one of the problems. There are some white people who say, "I don't want black people to have anything. I don't want them to be citizens," but we are. We in America, no matter what this small group that we keep talking about, and that junk about the minority is Donald Trump and his group. We are the majority. 75% of Americans don't agree with that. And so I really get upset with you journalists, or with the journalists, I would say you journalists, always talking about that the covers of magazines, or what did he say today? And people say, well, Donald Trump sells newspapers or magazines or whatever. I don't know what he sells, but I know that they overplay what he does. And I think that it's time that we quit having to listen to that.
I'm a little confused about how optimistic you are. I mean, you are, you know, in many ways, your generation proved that you can change the world for the better.
Mm-hmm.
But you're very pessimistic about earthlings.
Just humans.
So do you think this generation of young people can save the world, can make it a better place, or do you think it's foregone?
I don't think it's a question of save or not save at this point. I like the young generation. I like the fact that we have transgender students who are standing up for the right to create themselves, which is really what that's all that that amounts to. I think that their interest in politics, whether what's Ukraine's or Russian, Israelis or Gaza, you know, it's really nice to see the youngsters out there in the street saying, you know, this is wrong.
I mean, you must get a great kick out of watching young people to have been a teacher for as long as you have been. But I also wanted to ask you about Virginia Tech, because obviously I mentioned the massacre by a student you had taught and had identified as a bad piece of work. How do you explain, reconcile, think about the idea of there being evil young people amongst you?
If they're good young people, they have to be evil young people. And if they're young people that we love, they have to be young people that we hate. Because life is a two-way street. And everybody wants to make it, you know, a one-way. It's not. There are no one-way streets. And so in the case of Mr. Cho, I don't know. I just felt, you know, and I'm just a poet. And so all I have are words and all I have are my feelings. And I was just looking, I teach writing, and it was just like, no, this won't do. I'm reading this guy, and it's like, no, something is not working. And so I asked him, because I was nice enough about it. You know, I said, Mr. Cho, I don't think I'm your teacher for you. I can help you get into another class if you'd like, or, you know, tell me what you would like to do and we'll see if we can work on it. He said, I don't want another class. And I said, well, Mr. Cho, I don't think I've been making myself clear, because I said, I will not teach you. You will leave my class. Now, we can work this out in any number of other ways, but I teach on Tuesday and Thursday. I taught on Tuesday and Thursday. I said, this is Tuesday. On Thursday, one of us will not be in this class. And he said to me, well, what you going to do? I said, Mr. Cho, I didn't have a job when I came to Virginia Tech, and I'll walk out and not have a job. But you and I, and we're in my classroom. I mean, I don't have private conversation with students. And he said, oh, you'll never quit. And I said, Mr. Cho, you don't know me, but I know you. And this is what's going to happen on Thursday. One of us will not be here. And I dismissed the class. And I went to my department head and I said, I've got a student. And I told her about it. I said, somebody's got to go. And she said, oh, I don't think you understand him. And I said, no, I don't think you understand that I am not going to be in space with this person. Now, on Thursday, either you have gotten him out of my class, or Thursday by noon, there will be my resignation under your door. Now, you may not believe it. He didn't believe it. But I do. I know I will be gone. So it's on you.
And when it happened, what did you think?
When I heard about it, I was flying in. I was someplace else. I don't remember where. And I was flying in. So it was a Monday, and that I can tell you. And so I know he wasn't looking for me, because I'm never on campus on Monday. It wasn't personal. And they said, oh, my God, the plane was coming in. And one of the students on the plane said, oh, my God, 21 people have been killed at Virginia Tech. And all of us on the plane said, oh, you must have that wrong. It must be one or two, which was bad enough. But that's the way we looked. It must be one or two. But by the time we actually got landed, it was the numbers were going up. So I went on home. And, of course, by then, you know, the news is on and you knew. But I knew as I'm driving, I said, oh, this is Mr. Cho. I wish I had taken it up further. I just knew he couldn't come in my class or my office. And if I had taken it maybe to the provost, but I doubt that they would have kicked him out of school or anything. And it breaks my heart, because several of the students I knew, and one of my very favorite students, I always wanted to tell his mother, which I did. And I knew, his name is Matt. And I knew that Matty got shot in the chest, because he would never run. And it still makes me incredibly sad. And I just don't know what I could have done. And I was sorry I couldn't do more, but I got a call from the president's office, and Sandy Smith, who was his assistant, said, well, Nikki, we need you to close convocation. I didn't know we were having a convocation. And we waited. The president, George W. Bush, that Bush was there. And so I said yes, and I was trying to think of what to do. And I realized that what we needed at that point was a definition, and I'm big on definitions. We are Virginia Tech, not this. And I was amazed that your queen had, in fact, watched it. I wasn't even thinking about the queen. I was thinking about the 10,000 kids in front of me. And when she came to the United States, she asked to meet me, and I went over.
What did she say?
Hello. That same thing I did. I said, ma'am, how are you? She said, it was a lovely poem. I mean, it was one of those. And I just thought it was really nice because I had no idea that the queen, you're already sad because you've lost people. And that's it. It still makes me sad. I every time I think about Maddie, it just makes me really sad. I know that there were 32 other people, but, you know, you only cry for what you know. And I had no concept that the queen might be sitting watching me read a poem. Had no idea, and I'm glad I didn't, because it would have made me nervous.
I mean, that's the extraordinary thing about poems, isn't it? I mean, they can touch people in different worlds, effectively.
Yeah, but if I was going into space, which I really wish I was healthy and young, I'd do that. I would definitely take an anthology. I might put together, I should do that probably, put together an anthology, you know, space poems. Because you can read poetry over and over again. And every time you read it, you're getting something else out of it. And it's helping you get, sometimes you laugh, sometimes you I hadn't thought about it that way. But every time you read the same poem, you get something else out of it. And that's what's so wonderful about it. And so if I was young and healthy, which I am not and am not, and sitting on a rocket ship, fooling around in the galaxy, and some life form comes to the window, knock, knock, and I'd say, hello, because everybody knows a smile is universal. So I'd smile, and it would smile, and it'd come in, because obviously it knows more about how to get around than I do. And it would come in, and I'm a black woman, so I would do that thing that black women do. Are you hungry, baby? Because black women, you run into black women, I don't care where you run into, it's first thing we do is feed you. And so this life form would sit there. Maybe I'd make some, well, grits are really universal, and I make good grits. And so then we talk, and I'd say, this is a poem. I wrote it when I was, you know, 50 years old, and hand him the book. And I would smile, and that's what we would talk to. Or I would sing a song. Depends on, you know, what we... Because we sing, black women sing too.
Before we go, I wanted to just briefly ask you about one other thing you mentioned, which was perhaps a result of you smoking, which was that you had cancer, you had lung cancer.
Oh, yeah.
And you survived it, and they took out a lung.
Yeah, I don't know if I've survived it. Honestly, and
well, it was a long time ago, wasn't it?
I'm living with it. It was 13 years ago. And I always say it, and it's true, and I am going to, as we all will, die one day, but I don't want anyone to say she battled cancer, because cancer and I never battled. I wake up in the morning, you know, it's good morning, cancer, how you feeling today? You know, you want to go back to sleep, sweetheart? Now I'm going to go to work. You know, I've never battled cancer, because it's no point in ever fighting a fight you can't win.
So do you think of yourself as living with it?
Oh, of course.
Now
it's my friend, and I'm happy, and it's happy, and it likes champagne, because I do have a glass. That's, I'm going to have a procedure when I go back home, and that's what the hospital just called. And you know, they ask all these questions on what pills are you taking. I take so many pills, but the one thing is, do you drink alcohol? The answer is yes, of course. And my doctor won't let me drink red wine, so I drink champagne.
Finally, if you could change the world in any way, how would you change it?
I don't think I would change the world. I think what I don't ever want to happen, and that I do fight, I don't want the world to change me. I wrote a poem, Quilting the Black Eyed Pea, We're Going to Mars. We're going to Mars for the same reason Marco Polo rocketed to China. For the same reason Columbus trimmed his sails on a dream of spices. For the very same reason Shackleton was enchanted with penguins. For the reason we fall in love. It's the only adventure. We're going to Mars because Perry couldn't go to the North Pole without Matthew Henson. Because Chicago couldn't be a city without Jean-Baptiste DeSalvo. Because George Washington Carver and his peanut were the right partners for Booker T. It's a life-seeking thing. We're going to Mars because whatever is wrong with us will not get right with us. So we journey forth carrying the same baggage, but every now and then leaving one little bitty thing behind. Maybe drop torturing hunchbacks here. Maybe drop lynching Billy Budd there. Maybe not whipping Uncle Tom to death. Maybe resisting global war. One day looking for prejudice to slip. One day looking for hatred to tumble by the wayside. One day maybe the whole community will no longer be vested in who sleeps with whom. Maybe one day the Jewish community will be at rest. The Christian community will be content. The Muslim community will be at peace. And all the rest of us will get great meals on holy days and learn new songs and sing in harmony. We're going to Mars because it gives us a reason to change. If Mars came here, it would be ugly. Nations would band together to hunt down and kill Martians. And being the stupid, undeserving life forms that we are, we would also hunt down and kill what would be termed Martian sympathizers. As if the fugitive slave law wasn't bad enough then, as if the so-called war on terrorism isn't pitiful now. When do we learn, and what does it take to teach us? Things cannot be what we want, when we want, as we want. Other people have ideas and inputs, and why won't they leave Rap Brown alone? The future is ours to take. We're going to Mars because we have the hardware to do it. We have the rockets and the fuel and the money and the stuff. And the only reason NASA is holding back is they don't know if what they send out will be what they get back. So let me slow this down. Mars is 1 year of travel to get there, plus 1 year of living on Mars, plus 1 year to return to Earth, equals 3 years of Earthlings being in a tight space, going to an unknown place with an unsure welcome awaiting them. Tired muscles, unknown and unusual foods, harsh conditions, and no known landmarks to keep them human. Only a hope and a prayer that they will be shadowed beneath a benign hand, and there is no historical precedent for that. Except this, the trip to Mars can only be understood through Black Americans. The trip to Mars can only be understood through Black Americans. The people who were captured and enslaved immediately recognized the men who came, who chained and whipped them and herded them into ships so tightly packed there was no room to turn, no privacy to respect, no tears to fall without landing on another. We're not kind and gentle and concerned for the state of their souls, no. The men with whips and chains were understood to be killers, feared to be cannibals, known to be sexual predators. The captured knew they were in trouble in an unknown place without communicable abilities with a violent and capricious species. But they could look out and still see signs of home. They could still smell the sweetness in the air. They could see the clouds floating above the land they loved. But there reached a point when the captured could not only not look back, they had no idea which way back might be. There was nothing in the middle of the deep blue water to indicate which way home might be. And it was that moment when a decision had to be made. Do they continue forward with a resolve to see this thing through, or do they embrace the waters and find another world? In the belly of the ship, a moan was heard, and someone picked up that moan, and a song was raised, and that song would offer comfort and hope and tell the story. When we go to Mars, it's the same thing. It's middle passage. When the rocket red glares, the astronauts will be able to see themselves pull away from Earth. As the ship goes deeper, they will see a sparkle of blue. And then one day, not only will they not see Earth, they won't know which way to look. And that's why NASA needs to call Black America. They need to ask us, how did you calm your fears? How were you able to decide you were human, even when everything said you were not? How did you find the comfort in the face of the improbable to make the world you came to your world? How was your soul able to look back and wonder? And we will tell them what to do. To successfully go to Mars and back, you will need a song. Take some Billie Holiday for the sad days and some Charlie Parker for the happy ones, but always keep at least one good spiritual for comfort. You will need a slice or two of meatloaf, and if you can manage it, you will, and if you can manage it, some fried chicken in a shoebox with a moist lemon pound cake. A bottle of beer, because no one should go that far without a beer, and maybe a six-pack, so that if there is life on Mars, you can share. Popcorn for the celebration when you land, while you wait on your land legs to kick in. And as you climb down the ladder from your spaceship to the Martian surface, look to your left. And there you'll see a smiling community quilting a black eyed pea, watching you descend. Thank you. I know that some of you in this room don't write and some of you do. I just want to remind all of you that the first person who reads you is you. So if you're writing, remember, you are your first reader. I had a father who was crazy. Some of you have crazy fathers, and you may understand some of it, some of you don't. I worry sometimes, and I'm not going to run over, but you know, you worry sometimes. No, you do, because men are getting to be crazy, but I promised that I wouldn't do anything political, and I'm not, but... But Gus was, we called him Gus was crazy. And I've gotten to the point now that I can understand a little bit more, maybe about some of the things that made him crazy. But he's gone and it's none of my business. My mother was happy with him. But my sister, I would never have married him, believe me. But my, mommy didn't, she was happy with him. But my sister's name is Gary, and I'm the youngest. I'm the baby in the, well, no more. My aunt died on the 19th of March, and that made me the oldest person in the family. And that's so some of you have gone through that. I mean, all of a sudden, she died at 6:08 a.m., March 19th. So at 6:09 a.m., I became the oldest person in the family. And these are things, too, you have to adjust to. You know, you keep wondering, how am I going to handle this, and am I doing things right? But I wrote a poem for Gary, and Gary's been gone too. Mommy died on June 24th, and Gary died on August the 10th. So they went off to heaven and had a good time, and they were leaving us anyway. I wrote a poem, my sister and me. Chocolate cookies, chocolate cakes, chocolate fudge on chocolate lakes, chocolate kisses, chocolate hugs, two little chocolate girls in a chocolate rug. No one can find us, we're all alone. Two little chocolate girls running from home. Chocolate chickies, chocolate bunnies, chocolate smiles from chocolate mommies, chocolate rabbits, chocolate snakes, two little chocolate girls wide awake. What an adventure, my, what fun. My sister and me still on the run, still on the run, still on the run. My sister and me still on the run. I like it. Sometimes you write a poem just because, damn it, you want to. One of the things, I wanted to share this one. One of the things that bothers me now is, and I do not understand this, in all fairness, I don't know what Americans are afraid of. Everybody keeps running around saying things like, well, we want to be safe. From what? The craziest thing in the world is us. That's the truth. That is the truth. So I wrote a poem, which I really like, because, and especially those of you who write, you cannot be afraid, and you cannot be worried about who does and who doesn't like what you do, because there's always somebody's not going to like it. If nobody doesn't like it, something's wrong with it. That's the truth. It's a whore. It's a prostitute. If somebody isn't saying no, I agree that you have to say yes. But if somebody isn't not understanding it, something's wrong with it. You have made it do something. You're a whore, and you don't want to do that. You don't. I mean, think about Miles Davis. Think about Charlie Parker. Think about the people that everybody says, oh, I don't understand what they're doing. They were only a genius. If everybody understands you, you got to have an IQ of 3 or 4. That's the truth. I think fear should be a spice, something we sprinkle on our steaks just before they put them on the grill, something we mix in with our corn muffins and bake at 350 degrees for 20 minutes or until golden brown. Maybe we take fear leaves, decorate them on our apple pie right out of the oven, not before, or the leaves will burn and not nearly look so pretty. I'm thinking if we can learn to distill fear, we have two wonderful preparations, perfumes for smell, alcohol for ingestion. Perfume carries its own scent of danger and excitement, but when we throw a little fear in, things there really begin to heat up. Ask John Edwards or Herman Cain and see if I'm not right. Fear, the scent he can't resist. We'd have to find an exercise for it. We would want everybody to be able to get their hands on it. I'll have to form a committee to find that solution. Maybe the White House has some ideas. Or, yes, the Tiger Woods Emporium. Get your fear right here. You can practice your swing, whatever that might mean, while your bottle is bagged. And if we make it drinkable, we'd probably have a little light green liquid in its own 2-ounce top. You can take your fear on the rocks or sip a bit of Coke in there to make it mighty smooth. We could get the Culinary Channel to feature fear in one of their drink-offs, or we'd reward it the best new barrister with his or her very own good gold bottle of fear to be used anytime they like. I need to explain right here. It's not fear that causes problems. It's when hatred is combined with it. Fear is, as on its own, tells you not to lend your cousin money. Don't go down that dark street, girl. Take care of yourself. Take yourself home from this party now. Fear is a warning sign. Healthy. Good idea. That fish smells funny. My dog does not like this man. Fear. Fear is a good thing. It's why we want to keep it exclusive. If everybody can have fear, then we have to cut it, like drugs. It's not that cocaine kills you, it's the stuff they cut it with to make the drugs go further. You don't want pure fear, but you don't want to be able to cut it with hatred either. Hatred is a bad idea, which is why it's cheap and available anywhere you look. Maybe what will really work is when we all need to have a fear tree in our backyard, maybe a small fear plant growing in our apartment windowsill. When we are feeling uneasy, we pluck a few leaves and find the right place to put them. Champagne would be the number one choice, but spaghetti works too. Have a little fear at least once a week, and you can build up your resistance like a vaccination. Then when wars and hatreds come along, you'll be able to recognize that it's just another expression of fear. No thanks. I've had my share this week. And speaking of careers, the poem that definitely made people pay attention somewhat, let me pick this up, to my career. And you can't really overthink that. I mean, here's kid, nobody really listens to me, really. I knew some of these people, but nobody listened. If they had listened to me, none of this should be happening. Nobody listened to me. But, you know, you have to know where you are in all this. But I wrote a poem called Ego Tripping. And thank you. I really loved it because my mother's a jazz fan. And I think I know probably most crooks. I know quite a few, and quite a few murderers. And, well, somebody got to know them. But that's true. But when I did my third book, it was called Black Judgment. And I went to see a man called Harold Logan. Most of you probably don't know Harold Logan, but you do know Capone. You do know the Godfather. You know all of that. Well, you didn't see the black people in that, but there were black people, and Harold Logan was one of them. And I went to see Mr. Logan because I wanted the club. I wanted the jazz club that he had. It's called Birdland. And so I thought, well, all he can say is no. So I went down to see him, and Mr. Logan, how are you? I'm Nikki Giovanni. I write poetry. And so, you know, Logan is looking at me like, and I said, I'd like to have your club, because in New York, the clubs are closed on Sunday. I said, I'd like to have Birdland on Sunday to have a poetry reading. And Logan is looking at me, and he says, and what do I get? I said, well, Mr. Logan, what do you need? You know, let's work this one out. And he said, bring me 100 people, and you can have it for free. 99 people, and you'll owe me $500. I said, it works for me. Because, you know, you wanted your mother to be proud of you, and I thought, hell, I can get anybody can get 100 people to do any damn thing. That's the truth. You stand on a corner, you can get 100 people to do something. I mean, and so I started doing that. And that Sunday that we were having it, we're going to have a reading, that Sunday, Birdland is here. And the New York Times is there, for those of you who know New York. So the New York Times actually is looking down, and what they started to see about 3 o'clock is people coming, and people coming, and people coming. And it was a mixed group, but it's mostly a lot of black people. So what they were concerned about, speaking of fear, is what are all of these black people, and I'm sure they had another word for that, doing... doing there? What are they doing? And so they sent a reporter down, and the reporter said to the people, because we're turning the corner, what are you doing there? And the people said, Black Judgment is coming. you can see how that's going to go, right? And the reporter came out and said, I'm looking for Nick Giovanni. And I was standing there and said, I'm Nicky Giovanni. No, where is he? I'm looking for Nick Giovanni. I just thought either he'll learn or he won't. Didn't matter to me. But we did. We had the reading. It was really nice. My mother was very proud. And one of the things that I was excited, of course, about was a couple of the poems. And they had some good poems. And what we got was the second, for those of you who read the New York Times, we got the second news front. And they put, for the first time, a poem. And they put this poem. And I wanted to share it with you. I was born in the Congo. I walked to the Fertile Crescent and built a Sphinx. I designed a pyramid so tough that a star that only glows every 100 years falls into the center, giving divine, perfect light. I'm bad. I sat on the throne drinking nectar with Allah. I got hot and sent an ice age to Europe to cool my thirst. My oldest daughter is Nefertiti. The tears from my birth pains created the Nile. I am a beautiful woman. I gazed on the forest and burned out the Sahara Desert. With a packet of goat's meat and a change of clothes, I crossed it in 2 hours. I'm a gazelle. So swift, you can't catch me. For a birthday present when he was 3, I gave my son Hannibal an elephant. He gave me Rome for Mother's Day. My strength flows ever on. My son Noah built Newark, and I stood proudly at the helm as we sailed on a soft summer day. I turned myself into myself and was Jesus. Men intoned my loving name. All praises, all praises. I am the one who would save. I sowed diamonds in my backyard. My bowels deliver uranium. The filings from my fingernails are semi-precious jewels. On a trip north, I caught a cold and blew my nose, giving oil to the Arab world. I am so hip, even my errors are correct. I sailed west to reach east and had to round off the earth as I went. The hair from my head thinned, and gold was laid across 3 continents. I am so perfect, so divine, so ethereal, so surreal. I cannot be comprehended except by my permission. I mean, I can fly like a bird in the sky.
Nicky Giovanni, a fierce and lyrical voice whose work illuminated love, liberation, and the unyielding power of self-expression, has died. Tributes are now pouring in from across the country as admirers and friends mourn the passing of a literary legend. Writer, activist, and public intellectual Nicky Giovanni was an unmissable and unmistakable presence in American culture for more than 50 years.
I'm not ashamed of our history because I know there is more to come.
Her poetry and prose, published in more than 2 dozen volumes, grappled with race, sex, gender, and politics. And her commitment to fighting injustice inspired generations of Americans from all walks of life.
You cannot be afraid. And you cannot be worried about who does and who doesn't like what you do, because there's always somebody's not going to like it. If nobody doesn't like it, something's wrong with it.
Born Yolanda Cornelia Giovanni Jr. in 1943, Giovanni grew up in Cincinnati. At 15, she fled a turbulent family life and a father who was abusive to her mother.
I shouldn't say this on the radio, I guess, but it was clear that either I was going to kill him or I had to move. And so I decided to move.
If I dreamed natural dreams of being...
By the late 1960s, she had again moved to the Northeast, publishing militant, artful poetry that quickly made her a leading figure of the Black Arts Movement and a fiery feminist counterpoint to the machismo she found in certain pockets of the Civil Rights Movement. In 1971, in a now iconic interview with James Baldwin, Giovanni, then just 28 years old, spoke to the problems she saw in the way some Black women were treated in relationships.
Why are you going to be truthful with me when you lie to everybody else? You lied when you smiled at that cracker down the job, right? Lie to me, smile. Treat me the same way you would treat him.
I can't treat you the way I treat him.
You must. Because I've caught the frowns and the anger. He's happy with you. Of course he doesn't know you're unhappy. You grin at him all day long. You come home and I catch hell because I love you. I get least of you. I get the very minimum. And I'm saying, you know, fake it with me. Is that too much of the Black woman to ask of the Black man? For 10 years so that we can get a child on his feet that says, yeah, father smiled at mother. He talked to me about school today.
By 30, she was a genuine literary star, selling out Lincoln Center.
1 ounce of truth benefits like a ripple on a pond.
Over the next decades, she published frequently and toured widely, often reading her poetry against the backdrop of gospel music.
He looked at his dusty cracked boots to say, "Sister, my time is getting near."
Giovanni spent 35 years as a professor of English at Virginia Tech. The day after a shooting there that killed 32 people back in 2007, the community turned to her for solace amid the tragedy.
No one deserves a tragedy. We are Virginia Tech. The Hokie Nation embraces our own and reaches out with open heart and hands to those who offer their hearts and minds. We are strong and brave and innocent and unafraid. We are better than we think and not quite what we want to be.
She reminded us all to always be bold, to always speak your mind, to always lift your voice, and no matter who's watching or who's in the room, to be unafraid, to be unashamed.
Poet Kwame Alexander was a friend who had studied under Giovanni at Virginia Tech.
When I think of Black liberation and Black power and all these things that Nikki wrote about so eloquently, is I like to think of this thing I call matter-of-fact Black. The thing I think I learned from her, and that we have to remember our own humanity and not be defined by other people. And we got to remind America and the world of our humanity as well.
Among a lifetime of accolades, she won an American Book Award and was a 7-time recipient of the NAACP Image Award. And over a career that spanned more than half a century, she remained uncompromisingly herself.
What I know is that I will not let the world change me. I think that whatever it is that I have to give, I have some truths to give. I have, there's some laughter. I'm a Black woman. And Black women, despite all of it, we still find a way to laugh.
Giovanni is said to have continued working until her final days. Her final book of poetry, titled The Last Book, is set to be released next year. Nikki Giovanni died of complications from cancer. She was 81 years old.
Well, I think anybody who reads encountered Baldwin when they were, I did when I was a teenager, because he's been writing for quite some time. I was born in 43, so I've been going to libraries all of my life. And Jimmy, he was Mr. Baldwin to me at that particular time, was one of the first or one of the earlier Black writers writing essays. So, you know, you've been reading Baldwin because, again, you can read him and reread. And I think that that's probably a good mark for any writer, to be reread. But I think when my generation, because the Baldwin generation is 20 years older than we are, I think what we saw from them was you can tell the truth. So when I started coming up with my career, I was owed a favor by PBS Broadcasting. And they asked, the producer of the show, Soul, asked me, what did I want? And I said, if I could do anything, I would like to meet James Baldwin. And he said, I know Jimmy, I'll call him. And much to my surprise, he said, well, I'd love to talk to Nikki, but I don't have time to come to the States. Would she mind coming to London? I said, I'll walk to London to talk to James Baldwin. And we came to London, which is why the film, it's a documentary, and why it is, I think, so good, if I may, is that the British look differently at filming. And both Jimmy and I talk with our hands. The Americans would never have photographed our hands in the same way. So it was just really great being able to do this film with him. Describing Jimmy, he was a very gentle person. So he was a great storyteller. And I would describe him, one, as a great storyteller. And actually, when you look at Jimmy's face, he's a good-looking man. And it's kind of funny because at first you look and you think, oh, you know, this is not Harry Belafonte, you know, because Harry was sexy. And I don't think that Jimmy was sexy, but he was a good-looking man that somehow his presence always made you feel comfortable, that you didn't feel that you were in any danger, if I can use that term. Mostly with Jimmy, because he's a great storyteller, what you did was you sat and you listened. And again, those were for lack of a better word, the big kids. I'm a Southerner, and so I grew up with kids could be seen but not heard. And so when you're sitting at the table and James Baldwin's there and Nina Simone is there, or sometimes, you know, King would come in or whatever, because they knew everybody and everybody respected them. We're just the kids. And so the intelligent thing to do was to sit and listen, because you had nothing to add. If you thought something, then you went home and wrote a poem about it. But you had nothing to add to that conversation. It's so hard with Jimmy to say favorite, but I have read and reread Notes of a Native Son. And I think that, again, every time you read it, he wrote almost poetically. And so every time you read it, you're getting something else out of it. But one of my favorite lines, if I could say it that way, and it's not a happy line, but when the 13th Amendment was celebrating its 100th anniversary, I don't know if you know, but the 13th Amendment was the one that freed slaves. And he said, well, you're celebrating 100 years too soon. And I thought, yeah, only Jimmy could nail it like that, because we are still fighting to celebrate the freedom of not just the people of color, but of all people, of all genders, and for all reasons. So I thought that he really nailed it. I'd love to see a flag, you know, someplace there. You celebrated a little too early, you know. If I was introducing another life form from another galaxy, and they said, well, I've heard of this James Baldwin, what should I read? I would say, well, read Notes of a Native Son, because it not only tells you about being Black American, it tells you a lot about America, and it tells you about hope. But also, reading James Baldwin tells you something about genius, because he was a great writer. And that I used to laugh about, because we poets are always laughing at the novelists, but he was more than a novelist. And we'd always say, well, if it wasn't for poetry, you people couldn't write. But he was a poetic writer, but he told the truth, and he never backed off of it. So that's what I would always suggest. I think that's a good start.
That was Reflections on James Baldwin from Nikki Giovanni, taken to Bath a few years ago.
When I was a little girl in Indianapolis, sitting on doctor's porches with post-dawn pre-debs, wondering would my aunt drag me to church Sunday, I was meaningless, and I wondered if life would give me a chance to mean. I found a new life in the withdrawal from all things not like my image. When I was a teenager, I used to sit on front porch steps conversing the gym teacher's son with embryonic eyes about the essential essence of the universe, recognizing the basic powerlessness of me. But then I went to college, where I learned that just because everything I was unreal, I could be real, and not just real through withdrawal into emotional crosshairs or colored bourgeois intellectual pretensions, but from involvement with things approaching reality, I could possibly have a life. So catatonic emotions and time-wasting sex games were replaced with functioning commitments to logic and necessity, and the gray area was slowly darkened into a black thing. For a while, progress was made, along with a certain degree of happiness, because I wrote a book and found a love and organized a theater and even gave some lessons, some lectures on black history, and began to believe all good people could get together and win without bloodshed. Then Hammershko was killed, and Lumumba was killed, and Diem was killed, and Kennedy was killed, and Malcolm was killed, and Evers was killed, and Swerner, Cheney, and Goodman were killed, and Luizio was killed, and Stokely fled the country, and Leroy was arrested, and Rapp was arrested, and Pollard, Thompson, and Cooper were killed, and King was killed, and Kennedy was killed. And sometimes I wonder why I didn't become a debutante, sitting on doctor's porches, going to church all the time, wondering, is my eye makeup on straight? Or withdrawn, discoursing on the stars and the moon, instead of a for real black person who must now feel and inflict.
that's why I have a home in Pittsburgh.
It goes like this. It goes like this. It all about, maybe you can help me out. It goes like this. It goes like this.
Yeah.